The Duke of Blackwood acquired his wife in the same manner he acquired the failing estate to which she was attached, as a matter of fiscal hygiene. The transaction took place on a Tuesday, in a solicitor's office so thick with the dust of forgotten litigations that the light from the window fell in solid, hazy bars. He did not look at her, not properly. He registered her presence as one might register a piece of furniture included in the sale of a house, an object, present and accounted for, but of no immediate consequence. Her name was Ilara Vance, and the ink from her signature on the marriage contract was as black and final as the foreclosure of her family's history. Alistair, the Duke, saw the world as a series of assets and liabilities. The Vance estate, Fairwood, with its untended forests and fallow fields, was a liability that, with proper management, could become an asset. The debt her father had accrued was a malignancy to be excised. And the daughter, the final, non-negotiable term of the agreement, was a complication, a legal and social necessity, but an encumbrance nonetheless. He noted the straightness of her spine, the stillness of her hands, clasped in the lap of a gray dress that had seen better decades. He noted, in a detached, academic way, that she was not weeping. Her father, a man crumbling under the weight of his own poor decisions, had the decency to look wrecked. His shoulders were bowed, his face blotchy. Miss Vance, soon to be the Duchess of Blackwood, was simply there. A study in neutrality. She was present, and she was absent. She was there, and she was not there. This observation, brief and clinical, was the sum total of his consideration for the woman he had just legally bound himself to. The solicitor, a man named Finchley, whose jowls quivered with nervous energy, slid the final document across the mahogany table. Alistair signed his name with a swift, decisive flourish. A signature that had sealed trade deals and authorized the movement of capital across continents. Now, it sealed a life. He blotted the ink, stood up, and gave a curt nod that encompassed both the ruined father and the purchased daughter. "My carriage will be sent for her in the morning," he stated. "Not to her, but to the room at large." It was an instruction, not an offer. Then he turned and walked out, the dust motes swirling in the wake of his departure, leaving behind the silence of a completed transaction. The carriage ride to Blackwood Manor was a long, suffocating exercise in silence. Alistair had positioned himself in the corner, a book open on his lap, though he had not turned a page in the last hour. He was accustomed to silence, but this was a different quality. It was not empty. It was occupied by the profound and unnerving stillness of the woman seated opposite him. He had expected tears, or perhaps a flutter of nervous chatter. He would have preferred the chatter. It was easier to ignore. Instead, she sat, her gaze fixed on the passing landscape, her profile as clean and unforgiving as a line carved in stone. Her stillness was not passive. It felt deliberate. It was beginning to grate on his nerves. Section. He cleared his throat, the sound unnaturally loud in the enclosed space. "The journey is tedious. I trust you are not too discomfited." She turned her head, and for the first time, he was forced to actually look at her face. It was not beautiful in the conventional drawing-room sense. Her features were too defined, her mouth too wide, her eyes a shade of gray that seemed to absorb the light rather than reflect it. They were intelligent eyes. That was his first, surprising thought. "Discomfort is a relative state, Your Grace," she replied. Her voice was lower than he had anticipated, a calm contralto with no trace of deference or fear. "Compared to the alternative, a tedious journey is a luxury." The reply was not what he expected. It was dry, precise, and held a sliver of irony that pricked at his complacency. He had expected a simpering, "No, Your Grace. I am quite well. Thank you, Your Grace." He found himself momentarily without a response. He recalibrated. This was not a vapid debutante. This was something else. He gestured vaguely at the fields, rolling past. "That land there, beyond the river. It now falls under my administration. Part of the Fairwood holdings." The yield has been poor for years. He was testing her, he realized, seeing if she was capable of anything beyond monosyllabic agreement. The soil is acidic, she said, her gaze returning to the window. My father insisted on planting wheat. It requires a neutral pH. He never listened to the soil. He only listened to the merchants in London, who told him what was fetching the highest price. There was no bitterness in her tone. It was a statement of fact, a diagnosis. Alistair felt a flicker of something he could not name. It was not admiration. Not yet. It was surprise, a disruption of his initial assessment. He had catalogued her as an ornamental burden. The data was proving to be flawed. And what would you have planted? He asked, his curiosity, a dormant, seldom used muscle, beginning to stir. Oats, perhaps. Or rye. In the lower fields, where the water pools, flax would do well. And a rotation with clover would return nitrogen to the soil. In 3 years, you could have wheat again, if you were patient. She spoke of husbandry as if it were a mathematical equation. He, who managed his vast empire through ledgers and reports from men he paid to understand such things, was struck by the simple, tactile nature of her knowledge. She knew the land not as a column of figures, but as a living entity. He said nothing more for the remainder of the journey. He closed his book, but he did not retreat back into his thoughts. Instead, he watched her. He watched the way she observed the transition from the neglected, overgrown lands of her former home to the manicured, ruthlessly efficient landscapes of his. He saw a flicker of something in her expression, not sadness, but a kind of critical appraisal. When they arrived at Blackwood Manor, a Gothic revival behemoth of gray stone and severe angles, his butler, Finch, was waiting on the steps. Finch had been with the family for 40 years, a man as much a part of the house as the foundation stones. His face was a mask of professional impassivity, but Alistair knew he missed nothing. Your Grace, Finch said, bowing. His eyes, for a fraction of a second, moved to the new Duchess, Finch. This is the Duchess, Alistair said, the title feeling strange on his tongue. See to her needs. It was a dismissal. He turned to enter his study, the sanctuary where his real life, the life of numbers and strategies, awaited him. Your Grace. Ilara's voice stopped him. He turned back. She was still on the gravel drive, looking not at the imposing facade of the house, but at a section of the roofline. There is a loose slate on the westernmost gable, she said, her voice calm and matter-of-fact. And the pointing on the chimney stack next to it is crumbling. You will have a damp problem in the attic by winter if it is not addressed. She then turned and, without waiting for a response, followed a footman into the house, leaving the Duke of Blackwood standing on his own drive, staring at a roof he had owned for 15 years and never once truly seen. Finch's expression remained unchanged, but Alistair had the distinct and uncomfortable impression that the butler was profoundly, if silently, amused. The days that followed were a sequence of quiet disruptions. The new Duchess did not behave as he had anticipated. She did not attempt to redecorate. She did not fill the house with vapid friends. She did not demand a new wardrobe or a larger allowance. Instead, she requested access to the household ledgers. Finch reported this to him in the study, his tone impeccably neutral. Her Grace has asked for the account books for the past 5 years, Your Grace, and the estate maps. For what purpose? Alistair asked, frowning over a shipping manifest from Canton. She did not specify, Your Grace. She said only that she wished to understand the organism of the household. The organism of the household. It was a strange, biological turn of phrase. He grunted his assent. It was a harmless enough pastime. Better than meddling with his cook or rearranging the library, which was organized according to a system of his own devising, he did not see her for 2 days. The vastness of the house allowed for it. He took his meals in his study, as was his custom. He assumed she took hers in the cavernous dining hall or in her rooms. He did not ask. He did not, he told himself, care. But her presence was a low hum beneath the surface of the house's daily life. The quality of the silence had changed again. It was no longer the unnerving, deliberate silence of the carriage. It was a productive silence. He heard, occasionally, the faint sound of a pianoforte being played from the distant music room. The melodies were complex, mathematical, Bach, not the sentimental trifles he expected. One evening, he found a note on his desk, placed squarely in the center of his blotter. It was her handwriting, the same precise, clear script from the marriage contract. "The supplier for the household linens is charging you 17% above the market rate. The contract is with a cousin of the former housekeeper. I have taken the liberty of sourcing 3 alternate suppliers for your consideration. Their estimates are attached." He read the note, then the attached papers. The calculations were exact. The analysis, concise. She had identified a piece of minor, deeply embedded graft that had escaped his own auditors for years. It was a small amount, a pittance to a man of his wealth, but the principle of it, the inefficiency, annoyed him, and she had seen it in less than a week. He stared at the note for a long time. This was not a duchess. This was a quartermaster, an auditor. It was useful, but it was also unsettling. She was quietly mapping the arteries of his world, understanding its systems. He felt a strange sense of being observed, analyzed by the very object he had intended only to possess. The inciting incident, the moment the first crack appeared in the foundation of his carefully constructed indifference, came a week after her arrival. He was in his study, drowning in the chaotic paperwork from the Fairwood estate. It was worse than he had imagined. Decades of neglect, of foolish ventures and sentimental mismanagement. The ledgers bled red ink. Contracts were missing. Tenants were in arrears. It was a swamp, and he was sinking in it. His frustration mounted. The acquisition, which had seemed a sound strategic move to consolidate the neighboring lands, now felt like a mire. And she, the Duchess, was the living symbol of it. She was the human embodiment of this mess he had saddled himself with. Every time he saw her, silent and observant, he was reminded of the tangled, unprofitable reality of Fairwood. The box was the final indignity. A crate of her father's personal effects had been delivered, and on top of it, a smaller, more delicate box labeled simply Miss Vance's correspondence. It was another detail to manage, another loose end, another piece of this unwanted life cluttering up his own. He threw down his pen, the nib spattering ink across a useless deed. He strode to the door and pulled the bell rope with more force than was necessary. Finch appeared, silent as a ghost. Alistair gestured vaguely around the room, at the piles of paper that represented his new problem. "This entire affair, Finch, it is untenable." His voice was tight, with a frustration he rarely allowed himself to show. "The estate is one thing, that can be beaten into shape. But this arrangement." He paced, the polished floorboards groaning under his feet. He was thinking of his life before. Clean, orderly, uncomplicated by the presence of a quiet, gray-eyed woman who played Bach and analyzed his linen contracts. "This is a complication I do not need," he said, his voice low and hard. He stopped and looked at his butler, the man who managed the mechanics of his life. "Find her a place, a dower house on the coast, one of the prettier cottages in the village. I do not care. Just send her away. See that she is comfortable, but see that she is elsewhere." Finch's expression did not flicker, but a deep, profound stillness settled over him. For the first time in their long association, the butler's silence felt like a judgment. "Your Grace? You heard me, Finch. Handle it. Discreetly." He turned his back, a clear dismissal. He did not see the butler's slow, deliberate nod. He did not see the deep, sorrowful line that etched itself between Finch's brows. And he did not see the slim figure in the gray dress who had been passing the study door, which was ever so slightly ajar. He did not see her pause, her hand hovering near the doorframe. He did not see her face, which for a single stark moment lost its placid neutrality and became a mask of sharp, crystalline comprehension. Ilara Vance, the Duchess of Blackwood, heard every word. She did not gasp. She did not cry out. She simply stood, frozen in the hallway, as the words echoed in the space where her fragile, nascent hopes had been. Send her away. It was not a sentence delivered in anger. It was worse. It was an administrative order. A man tidying his desk. She was not a person to be divorced or argued with. She was an object to be relocated, an inconvenience to be filed elsewhere. She lowered her hand from the doorframe. She turned, her movements fluid and utterly silent. She walked back the way she had come, her posture as straight as it had been in the solicitor's office. Nothing in her outward appearance betrayed the fact that a door inside her had just been quietly, definitively, and irrevocably closed. She returned to her suite of rooms. They were grand and impersonal, decorated in heavy damask and dark wood. She had changed nothing. She had not allowed herself to. It had been an act of caution. Now it seemed like an act of profound foresight. She sat not in one of the grand, uncomfortable chairs, but on the simple wooden stool before the writing desk. For a long time, she did nothing. She simply breathed, in and out, a slow, steady rhythm. She was not panicking. She was calculating. He wanted her gone. Very well. She would go. But she would not be sent, like a piece of unwanted luggage. She would not be installed in a pretty cottage like a pensioned-off servant. She had signed a contract. She had held up her end of the bargain, trading her name and her freedom for the security of her father's legacy, however tarnished. He had just rendered that contract meaningless. He had broken the spirit of the law, if not the letter. A strange, cold clarity settled over her. The hurt was a deep, frozen ache beneath her ribs, but on the surface, her mind was sharper than ever. He had never seen her, not for a moment. He saw a symbol, a problem, a line item in a ledger. He had no concept of who she was. The irony was that, in that single, brutal command, he had given her back her freedom. She walked over to the bell pull and summoned her new maid, a young, nervous girl named Anna. Anna, she said, her voice perfectly even, please have a small trunk brought up, and inquire with the stables as to the schedule for the morning train to London. The maid's eyes widened. Her grace is traveling? I am, Ilara said. She gave the girl a small, reassuring smile that did not reach her eyes. A matter of some urgency has arisen. She spent the next few hours packing. It was a methodical, precise process. She did not take the opulent gowns that had been laid out for her, the wardrobe of a duchess. She packed the simple, practical dresses she had arrived in. She packed her books. She packed a small, locked case containing papers and notebooks, filled with what looked like gibberish, but was in fact her life's work. She left the room almost as she had found it, impersonal, untouched. But on the writing desk, she placed a single sheet of paper. It was not a letter of recrimination. It was not a plea. It was a folded, formal request from the Foreign Office, dated a fortnight prior, that had been delivered to her father's house, and which she had brought with her to Blackwood. It requested the urgent assistance of Miss Ilara Vance in a matter of national security. She placed it there, in the center of the desk, and walked out of the room, closing the door softly behind her. She did not look back. The next morning, Alistair awoke with a sense of grim resolution. The mess of Fairwood still awaited him, but the peripheral complication, the human element, was being dealt with. He trusted Finch to be efficient. He came downstairs expecting a day of solitary, productive work. He was in the breakfast room when the first disruption occurred. A carriage, moving at a speed far too urgent for a social call, crunched up the gravel drive. Finch appeared at the door moments later. Your Grace, the Foreign Secretary, Lord Ashworth, is here to see you. He says the matter is of the utmost urgency, Alistair frowned. Ashworth was not a man given to early morning calls. He rose and went to the main hall to greet him. The Foreign Secretary was a man perpetually harried, his face a roadmap of political anxieties. Today, he looked worse than usual. Blackwood, Ashworth said, forgoing any pleasantries. I must speak with your wife. Alistair blinked. My wife? Yes, yes, the Duchess. Miss Vance, that is. Where is she? We have a crisis. Before Alistair could formulate a reply, a second carriage arrived, this one bearing the crest of the Exchequer. The Chancellor, Sir Robert Peel, a man whose dour expression was a national institution, emerged, looking equally agitated. He was followed by a third man, a thin, bird-like creature Alistair recognized as Sir Giles Martin, the head of the Crown's intelligence operations. The three most powerful ministers in the government were now standing in his hall, and they were all looking for his wife. Blackwood, for God's sake, man, where is she? The Chancellor demanded. The Portuguese delegation has moved up the talks. The cipher they are using has changed. We are blind. We need Miss Vance. Miss Vance? Alistair repeated, the name sounding foreign. He felt a profound sense of dislocation, as if the world had suddenly tilted on its axis. You mean the Duchess? Sir Giles stepped forward, his eyes like chips of ice. We mean the finest cryptographer this nation possesses, Duke. We mean the woman who broke the French naval codes last spring and averted a trade war. We call her Miss Vance because that is the name on her contract with the Crown, a contract that predates yours, I might add. Now, where is she? The room fell silent. The three ministers stared at him. Alistair stood, utterly poleaxed, the architecture of his world crumbling around him. The quiet, gray girl, the addendum to a land deal. A cryptographer, the nation's finest? He turned to Finch, who had been standing by the door, his face a perfect, unreadable mask. Finch, find the Duchess. Tell her she has visitors. Finch bowed. There was a beat of silence, a pause that stretched for an eternity. I am afraid that will not be possible, Your Grace. Alistair's head snapped back to him. What do you mean, not possible? Her Grace is not here, Your Grace, Finch replied, his voice soft but clear. She left on the 6 o'clock train this morning. She was gone. The words hung in the air of the great hall, simple, factual, and utterly devastating. The ministers exchanged looks of horror and frustration. Gone? Ashworth exploded. Gone where? Did she not understand the urgency? Alistair could not answer. He was reeling, trying to process the impossible information. The quiet woman who knew about crop rotation and loose slates on the roof was also a secret weapon of the state. The inconvenience he had ordered sent away was, it appeared, indispensable. Did she leave a message? A forwarding address? Sir Giles pressed, his voice sharp with impatience. No, Sir Giles, Finch said. Her Grace left no address. Alistair's mind, usually so clear and linear, was a maelstrom of confusion. He felt a fool, a colossal, blind, arrogant fool. He had possessed a thing of immense and unknown value, and he had not only failed to recognize it, he had actively discarded it. He dismissed the ministers with a curt promise he had no idea how to keep. I will find her. I will handle this. They left, their carriages churning the gravel in their haste and fury, leaving Alistair alone in the sudden, ringing silence of his hall. He stood there for a long time, the cold of the marble floor seeping into his bones. He began to notice her absence. It was not a single sharp pang, but a slow, creeping realization, an accumulation of voids. He walked through the house, a stranger in his own domain. The silence from the music room was no longer productive. It was empty, a dead space. He had grown accustomed to the sound of Bach in the afternoons, and now its absence was a physical presence. He went to the dining room for his midday meal. The long, polished table reflected the gray light from the tall windows. The place setting at the far end, which had always been there, was gone. The chair was pushed perfectly into place. An empty chair was somehow more present than a filled one had ever been. He found he had no appetite. He retreated to his study, the place of his power and control. It felt different. He looked at the stacks of paperwork from Fairwood, the source of his frustration the previous day. Now, they seemed not just a problem, but a monument to his own spectacular ignorance. He thought about her words in the carriage. He never listened to the soil. He had not listened. He had not looked. He had not seen. He began to walk the path he imagined she had taken. He went to her rooms. They were pristine, cold, impersonal. The bed was made with military precision. The wardrobe was closed. It was as if she had never been there at all, a ghost who had passed through without leaving a trace. But she had left a trace. On the writing desk, exactly where she had left it, was the single, folded sheet of paper. He picked it up. He recognized the seal of the Foreign Office. He read the formal, stilted prose. Request the continued invaluable assistance of Miss Alara Vance. Dot. Matters of the highest sensitivity concerning the Portuguese ciphers. He sank into the chair at the desk, the letter trembling in his hand. She had known. She had known the ministers would come for her, and she had left this here for him to find. It was not an accusation. It was a statement of fact. It was a final, quiet presentation of the evidence of her worth and of his blindness. And then, the final, crushing piece of the puzzle fell into place. He remembered his words to Finch, spoken in this very room. Send her away. The study door had a habit of swinging slightly ajar. He remembered the faint creak of a floorboard in the hall at the time, a sound he had dismissed as the house settling. She had heard him. The realization was not a flash of lightning. It was a slow, cold tide of shame that rose from the pit of his stomach and filled his entire being. It was the horrifying, undeniable knowledge of his own cruelty, not a hot-blooded, passionate cruelty, but a cold, careless, administrative cruelty that was somehow infinitely worse. He had treated a human being, a woman of extraordinary hidden genius, his wife, as a logistical problem to be solved. He thought about her stillness in the solicitor's office, and now saw it not as apathy, but as immense control. He thought about her dry, intelligent answers in the carriage, and saw not a fluke, but a glimpse of a mind he had been too arrogant to engage with. He thought about her note regarding the linen supplier, and saw not an oddity, but an offer of partnership he had been too blind to accept. He dropped the letter on the desk and put his head in his hands. The silence of the house pressed in on him, a silence filled with the ghost of her quiet competence, a silence that was the direct result of his own monumental folly. Finch, he said, his voice rough. He had not realized the butler had entered the room, standing by the door with a silver tray bearing a glass of brandy Alistair had not asked for but suddenly, desperately needed. Your Grace. End. Alistair looked up, his face stripped bare of its usual ducal authority. Where would she have gone? Finch placed the tray on the corner of the desk. His gaze was direct, and for the first time, Alistair saw not a servant, but a man. A witness. Her Grace has an aunt, a Lady Beatrice Vance, a widow. She resides in a modest house in Bath. The information was offered simply. A key. Ready my fastest horse, Alistair said, standing up. The lethargy was gone, replaced by a fierce, desperate urgency. Not the carriage, the horse. At once, Your Grace. Finch paused at the door. May I say, Your Grace? Her Grace. Also requested the train schedules for Bath yesterday evening. It was the final gentle twist of the knife. She had not fled in a panic. She had planned her departure with the same cool, methodical precision she applied to everything else. She had made a strategic retreat. Alistair nodded, unable to speak. He was not going to Bath to retrieve a national asset for the government. He was not going to reclaim his duchess. He was going to find a woman he had wronged, and he was going to do the one thing he had never done in his life. He was going to admit that he was wrong. The ride to Bath was a punishment. Every league, every thud of his horse's hooves on the road, was a measure of his folly. He rode through the night, stopping only to change mounts, fueled by a self-loathing so profound it felt like a physical illness. The wind whipped at his face, cold and sharp, but it was nothing compared to the cold inside him. He saw her face in his mind's eye, not as the neutral mask she presented to the world, but as he imagined it in the moment she overheard him, the flicker of comprehension, the dawning of a terrible quiet certainty, he had not just insulted her, he had confirmed her deepest, most cynical suspicions about the nature of their union and his character. He had validated her invisibility. He arrived in Bath as dawn was breaking, the pale light washing over the honey-colored stone of the city. He looked a mess. His coat was spattered with mud, his face gray with exhaustion and stubble. He, the Duke of Blackwood, who was never seen in public in a state of anything less than immaculate perfection, did not care. He found the address Finch had given him. It was a respectable but unassuming house in a quiet crescent, a world away from the Gothic grandeur of Blackwood Manor. A small, well-tended garden bloomed in the front. He dismounted, his legs stiff, and walked to the front door. His knock was answered by a woman in her late 60s, with eyes as gray and intelligent as her niece's. She wore a simple morning dress and looked at him with an expression of profound disapproval. This was clearly Lady Beatrice Vance. "Your Grace," she said, her voice laced with ice. "To what do we owe this unexpected honor?" "I am here to see my wife," Alistair said, his own voice hoarse. "The Duchess of Blackwood is not receiving visitors," Lady Beatrice replied, making a move to close the door. "Please," he said. The word was alien on his tongue. He never pleaded. He commanded. But he was not a duke now. He was just a man, standing on a doorstep, stripped of his authority. "I must speak with her." Lady Beatrice studied his face, his disheveled state, the raw exhaustion in his eyes. She saw something there that made her pause. Why? It was a simple question, but it demanded a universe of answers. "Because I was a blind, arrogant fool," he said, the truth raw and unvarnished, "and I need to tell her so." The old woman's expression softened by a fraction. She held his gaze for a long moment, then stepped back, opening the door just enough for him to enter. "She is in the garden." He walked through the small, tidy house. It was filled with books and light, a stark contrast to the opulent gloom of his own home. He stepped through a set of French doors and into a walled garden at the back of the house. And there she was. She was on her knees, wearing a simple apron over her dress, her hands covered in dirt. She was tending to a bed of roses, carefully pruning away dead wood. She did not look like a duchess. She did not look like the nation's greatest cryptographer. She looked like a woman tending her garden. She looked at peace. She must have heard his footsteps on the gravel path, because she paused, her hand holding the shears mid-snip. She slowly rose to her feet, wiping her hands on her apron. She looked at him, her expression unreadable. There was no anger, no surprise, only a quiet, waiting stillness. He stopped a few feet from her. The air was filled with the scent of damp earth and roses. He had rehearsed 100 speeches on the ride here, 100 ways to explain, to justify. They all turned to ash in his mouth. There was no justification. "I came," he started, his voice cracking slightly. He cleared his throat. "I came to tell you that I was wrong." He said the words, and the world did not end. He felt not diminished, but strangely, unburdened. "I was wrong," he repeated. The words, coming more easily now. "What I said, what you heard, it was the act of a blind man, a man who looks at a ledger and thinks he is looking at the world. I did not see you. At all. I saw a complication. An entry in a column. And I was a fool." She watched him, her gray eyes searching his face. She said nothing. Her silence was a crucible, burning away his pride, his defenses, leaving only the raw, shameful truth. "The ministers came," he continued, feeling the need to fill the void. "Ashworth, Peel, Sir Giles. They are frantic. They need you. The country needs you." A faint, ironic smile touched her lips. "And is that why you are here, Your Grace? To retrieve a national asset?" "No," he said, the word coming out with a force that surprised him. "Damn the ministers. Damn the ciphers. I am here because I said something unforgivable to a woman I had fundamentally failed to understand. I am here because I am ashamed. I am ashamed. I am ashamed. I am ashamed. Damn the ciphers. Just then, a voice called from the street beyond the garden wall. Hello there. Is the little code breaker in residence? Alistair stiffened. He recognized the voice. It was Lord Harrington, a man who embodied everything shallow and cynical about the world he moved in. He had been a rival for a land deal once, a man Alistair despised for his vacuous entitlement. Harrington's face appeared over the top of the garden wall, a smirk firmly in place. Ah, Blackwood, I heard your new bride had flown the coop, came to offer my condolences, and perhaps offer the lady a more appreciative arrangement. Rage, pure and hot, surged through Alistair. It was the rage of a man seeing his own past arrogance mirrored in another's face. But he did not move towards Harrington. He looked at Alara. He saw the faint tightening of her jaw, the flicker of disgust in her eyes. He took a step, not towards Harrington, but to stand slightly in front of her, a subtle, protective shift. He turned his head and looked at the man on the other side of the wall. His voice, when he spoke, was not loud. It was deadly cold. Harrington, he said, this woman is the Duchess of Blackwood. She is my wife, and she is worth more than you and every acre you own. If you ever speak to her again, if you ever come within a mile of her, I will dismantle your life, piece by piece, until you are begging for scraps on a street corner. Now get out of my sight. Harrington's smirk vanished, replaced by a look of shocked disbelief. He saw the utter lethal sincerity in the Duke's eyes, and he scrambled away from the wall without another word. Alistair turned back to Alara. The garden was silent again, save for the buzzing of a bee. He had not defended his property. He had defended her. And in that moment, something shifted between them. The impenetrable wall of her composure showed its first crack. She looked at him, truly looked at him, and he saw not a cryptographer, not a duchess, but the woman he had married. And for the first time, he felt the devastating, terrifying, and exhilarating possibility of what it might mean to be her husband. Ilara did not agree to return to Blackwood immediately. His apology, his public defense of her, had been necessary. They had been the key that unlocked a door. But the room beyond was not one of unconditional surrender. It was a negotiating table. I will return, she said, her voice still quiet but now imbued with a new authority. On certain conditions. Alistair, who had never accepted conditions from anyone, simply nodded. Name them. He expected a list. A demand for a separate residence, a larger allowance, a formal apology in writing. My work for the Crown continues, she said. It is not a hobby, it is my profession. I will require a secure study and the freedom to travel to London when necessary. My correspondence is not to be interfered with. Agreed, he said instantly. The income from that work is my own, to be used as I see fit. A portion of it will go towards the restoration of Fairwood. Of course. And you, she said, her gaze pinning him. You will make an effort to see. That is the final condition. It is not something that can be written into a contract. It is a standard of conduct. I will not be an object in your house again. I will be its duchess, or I will be nothing at all. He met her gaze. He understood completely. Her terms were not about money or freedom. They were about perception. She was demanding that he continue the process that had begun in his study when he found her letter. The process of truly seeing her. I accept your terms, he said. The rebuilding period was a quiet, delicate affair. It was a slow, painstaking reconstruction of a relationship that had never truly been built in the first place. He did not try to force intimacy. He gave her space. He ordered the finest carpenters to convert a suite of rooms overlooking the quietest part of the estate into a new study for her. He had a special lock fitted and gave her the only key. He began to court his own wife. It was a strange and often awkward process. He would find her in the library and, instead of retreating to his own wing, he would ask what she was reading. He started reading the same books, not just on politics and history, but poetry and philosophy. Their conversations, at first stilted and formal, began to flow. They became intellectual duels, arguments over Hume and Locke, discussions of agricultural theory, debates about the nature of governance. He discovered the dry wit he had first glimpsed in the carriage was a rich vein running through her. She could dismantle one of his arguments with a single, perfectly aimed question that left him both frustrated and deeply impressed. He learned to listen. He would come to her new study in the evenings, not with demands, but with a tray of tea. He would sit in the chair opposite her desk and simply watch her work, the intense concentration on her face as she stared at pages of meaningless numbers, her mind navigating a world he could not even begin to imagine. He found it fascinating. He started bringing the Fairwood ledgers to her, not as a burden, but as a consultation. "I am at a loss here," he would say. "The tenant contracts are a disaster." And she would look up from her ciphers, take the ledger, and within an hour, have a clear, logical path forward. She was not just intelligent, she was brilliant. Her mind was a finely tuned instrument, and he had been content to leave it in its case, unheard. The regret was a constant, low ache, but it was a productive ache. It spurred him on. The resolution of the Portuguese crisis became their first joint project. She worked on the ciphers, while he used his network and political influence in London to feed her scraps of information, to create diversions, to protect her from the impatient meddling of the ministers. They worked in tandem, a silent partnership conducted through coded telegrams and late-night conversations. When she finally broke the code, she did not make a grand announcement. She simply walked into his study late one night, placed a single sheet of paper on his desk, and said, "The trade concessions are a bluff. They are on the verge of bankruptcy. Tell Ashworth to hold his nerve." He did. The crisis was averted. Britain gained a significant diplomatic victory. At a reception at court a month later, the Prime Minister himself sought them out. He took Alistair's hand, but he looked at Alara. "Your Grace," the Prime Minister said to her, his voice loud enough for the surrounding throng to hear, "the crown is in your debt. Lord Ashworth tells me your insights were decisive." It was a public acknowledgement of her worth, of her secret life. Alistair felt a surge of pride, so fierce it almost staggered him. He looked at his wife, standing beside him in a simple but elegant dark blue gown, her expression composed, but a faint, triumphant light in her eyes. In that moment, surrounded by the glittering elite of the nation, he had never been more certain of anything in his life. Later that night, back at Blackwood, he found her in the library, a book open in her lap. The house was silent around them. "Ilara," he said, using her given name for the first time without it feeling like a formality. She looked up. "I love you," he said. The words were simple, unadorned, and felt more true than any financial statement or legal contract he had ever signed. "Not because you are a genius, or a duchess, or a national asset, but because you are you. Because you see the world as it is. Because you taught me how to see it too." She closed her book and set it aside. She rose and came to him, and for the first time, she closed the distance between them herself. She placed her hand on his cheek. "And I," she said, her voice soft, "have come to believe you." A year later, the Duke and Duchess of Blackwood were seated not in the grand library of Blackwood Manor, but in the smaller, sunnier library of a newly restored Fairwood. The scent of fresh plaster and beeswax mingled with the old, familiar smell of books. The ledgers on the large central table were now all written in black ink. Alistair was no longer just the Duke of Blackwood. He was a man in love with his wife. He watched her as she made a note on an estate map, her brow furrowed in concentration. He had learned the geography of her expressions, the slight frown of concentration, the subtle upward tick of her lips when she was amused, the clear, calm light in her eyes when she was happy. Their lives had intertwined. His vast global concerns and her quiet, intense world of ciphers and soil had merged. He now saw his empire not just as a machine for generating wealth, but as an ecosystem, an organism, as she had once called it. He consulted her on everything, not out of duty, but because her perspective was invariably the one he was missing. She was his partner, in every sense of the word. She looked up and caught him watching her. She smiled, a genuine, unguarded smile that still had the power to take his breath away. "You are staring, Your Grace," she murmured. "I am," he admitted. "I am looking at my wife." He remembered that first day, in the dusty solicitor's office. He had seen a footnote, an encumbrance. He had acquired an estate and a wife. Now, he looked at the woman before him, her hand resting lightly on her swollen belly, and he knew the truth. He had not acquired anything that day. He had been given a gift he was too blind to see, a treasure he had almost thrown away. The estate, the title, the wealth, they were the footnotes. She was the story.